Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. It's a technology update day today on the show, and we're talking about how to handle computer problems remotely and getting the latest on tech support scams. And back with us once again, Jesse LeGrew, Information Security Architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. And as we talk with Jesse, I hope you'll join in. Ever had your computer repaired remotely? I've had that happen quite a few times, as a matter of fact. What was your experience like? Join in with your general tech questions, or you can call us at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Again, that's 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Jesse, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Let's talk about downloading software first, just to begin the show, and the possible risks that can come with it. What are the different ways you can download software onto your computer?
Yeah, there's almost an unlimited number of ways you can kind of do this. The most common is you have a web browser, you search for what you want, you find a website to download the software you're looking for, you download it, install it, and, you know, kind of go about your day-to-day business. It's pretty common when you have a very specific problem that you're looking to solve. And so not all of those pieces of software come equipped on your device when you purchase it from a store. You usually have to purchase or download or install it in some way. And it's really easy to try to find those solutions online. It's very infrequent these days where you go to a store, buy a CD or a DVD or a flash drive that has your software. You're usually going to go to a website, and maybe it's free software, maybe it's paid software, but you're going to go ahead, basically perform all those transactions online, download the software and install it, which especially, for I think all of us looking to save a little bit of money, there's always the interest in the free versions of software, which is usually where there can be a little bit more danger, because they tend to show up in search results, and the software downloaded could be malicious. Maybe it actually solves the problem you're looking to solve, but it could actually be doing something in the background as well.
Okay, so, and this seems to have been, this whole business of downloading software off Google has become kind of more dangerous, hasn't it, over the past couple of months in particular?
Yeah, we've definitely seen, you know, more downloads of, you know, packages that might be dangerous, looking to do something bad to a device or maybe collect information from an end user. The interesting thing is it actually is something that has been around for decades. So I think when I was younger, one common thing that I had seen was maybe it was downloading music. Maybe it was downloading game patches that would allow you to either enhance your gaming experience or, in other cases, maybe get around licensing restrictions or all the things that were required for you to play the game. It was very, very common for those downloads to have something bad that came with it, some kind of software that would try to collect data from your computer, allow somebody to remotely connect to your device or to do something else. You might not notice it solves the problem that you need, but there's something else that kind of comes along with it. But we've been seeing that, you know, a lot more recently. And there've also been reports recently of individuals or groups taking advantage of Google ad services where, you know, if you're using Google, you might have sponsored suggestions or advertisements that show up at the very top of your browser list. There have been reports of some of those ads actually directing towards malicious content. So kind of another, you know, dangerous factor in there are people taking advantage of other organizations to make their illegitimate software look more legitimate.
Yeah. So how do you protect yourself from this? It's malware, isn't it?
Yeah, malware. It could be, you know, a virus. There's basically it's just software that's doing something you don't want it to do. And the best thing that I can recommend, I do tend to look at reviews. I tend to look at a variety of resources to see whether the software is legitimate, whether there are paid versions. And actually, in many cases, if somebody is looking for software, and you notice that it's coming from a reputable company that you've heard of before, check the URL. Is it actually coming from that website? Does it look familiar? A lot of the paid versions of software may have free versions available for personal use. And so that can help to give you an indication. This is probably safer. It is from a reputable company. They are, you know, selling commercial versions of this tool or software to others, and so you can be a little bit safer. That's usually my recommendation. If you don't, if the website looks unusual, if it has odd characters, if it's nothing that seems like normal from a day-to-day perspective, I would avoid it. Don't click on the link. Don't go to that website. But also, as kind of protection, you know, make sure your antivirus is enabled. Have those features turned on your computer so that maybe, you know, you do click on something. Hopefully, there's actually a higher chance that your device is going to say, "Hey, you downloaded the software. It looks bad, so you might want to remove it." And the browsers are also really good at trying to do that these days, where they might notify you, you know, you downloaded something from a website that seems malicious, or the download itself seems malicious. So if you have those features on your browser, make sure those are turned on, but also make sure they're fully updated. And that kind of goes with, you know, everything else. Keeping everything updated, turning on those security features can help you out in the event you do click on something that goes to a place that's a little bit more dangerous.
I've got automatic updates. Is that the kind of the best way to go, to have it automatically updating, or is that create some problems?
That's always what I recommend. Every now and again, there will be a problem with an update where it will do something you don't want it to do, and maybe it'll actually break the software. There are always reports of that happening. It happens probably just about with every company out there. Bugs kind of creep in. That being said, I think they're relatively infrequent for standard day-to-day users. I always recommend turning it on. If you have to remember to do the updates yourself, it's probably going to be less likely the updates are going to happen. And if you do have an issue with a piece of software and you know, need to go back to a previous version, most software packages that are very well maintained tend to have a method to go back to a previous version. So my web browser got patched. Turns out that patch had an issue. Usually there's going to be a way to download the older version and install that so that you can continue to work until that patch is resolved. So it's a good thing to do all around.
So during the highlight of COVID, when we were all working from home, Mark Abramson, the IT guy at the Department of Life Sciences Communication, and I would be on the phone quite a bit. And he would be remotely taking over my computer and fix whatever problem happened to be coming up. And so, you know, he didn't have a need to come in, and it's happened since then, as well. You don't need to take your device in, and it's a nice thing. But how, for someone who hasn't done this before, how to describe how it all works?
Yeah, there's a couple ways to do it. So it can be really nice. So I've done, you know, help for family and friends as well. And sometimes just traveling to a place just takes too long. So having remote access can be really, really useful. There are usually a few different ways I recommend people do that. One could actually be through a meeting application. So, you know, if it's Zoom, if it's Teams, if it's some other meeting application, a lot of them have remote screen control capabilities, which allows somebody to take a look and potentially fix things. So a lot of those options are either at low cost or free. Doesn't necessarily require any software to be installed. You can just go ahead and connect to your meeting, do a screen share, remote control, and You have those options up and running, similar options built into macOS and Windows. But usually if somebody doesn't want to download software, that can be one of the easiest ways to go, because also many times they're also browser-based. Otherwise, kind of get to the next tier, which is you download a piece of software that allows somebody to remotely connect to your computer, usually on a one-time basis, where you give them a code, they type it in, and they're remotely connected to your computer. There's a variety of software packages out there. Some are free for personal use. Some you may have to pay for, but it can be a really good option, low cost. The downside is you have to instruct someone to download the software and do everything through those steps, which can also be a bit challenging depending on, you know, the individual that you're helping or that's helping you. And so one of the other items that I recommend is you can actually get, they call like an agent. So it's something you install on your device, and it might allow somebody remote access anytime that they want you to remotely access your computer. Maybe it gives you a pop-up where you have to hit I accept, but they can help you remotely connect and do whatever they need to do on your computer. Many of those tend to be paid options because it's kind of a more feature-rich experience, and you have that remote capability 24/7. But a lot of these applications for personal use on personally owned devices offer that for free. So you can also have it where, you know, if say my mother called me and said, hey, I have an issue with this, with my computer, walking her through the process might be a little bit more cumbersome, but I can hit a button on my side, connect to her computer. She hits, yes, I agree to this. And then I can see what she's seeing and we can kind of walk through the problem together. And those remote control or remote tech service applications can be very useful, one for fixing issues, but also if you just try to walk somebody through something, it's hard to do that on the phone when you can't see what somebody else is seeing. So I highly respect the people that have done that on a day-to-day basis, because it's really challenging, because you can only guess to a certain extent on what somebody is seeing when you both have the same display in front. It can be extremely helpful to kind of walk through a process or to allow somebody to just remotely control the device and go ahead and fix a problem. So there's lots of great options. Once again, some are free, some are paid for. But especially for personal use, I'm sure everyone has somebody out there that either helps them or that they help, where this can be useful, because those people might be hours away or even days away, depending on the distance geographically.
Jesse LeGrew, our guest, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Questions for him? What's going on with your computer, maybe even your phone? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Trina LaSousa, our engineer today. Clara Neipert, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Jesse LeGrew, our guest today. We are talking technology with him today. Your variety of computers that you may have in your home or at work and are having some issues with, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Had a good friend at work at the UW who got a pop-up that said, you know, there's a problem with your computer. You need to call this number. And that person called the number and gave over control to his computer and then got suspicious about halfway through and cut it off and ran immediately to the Division of Information Technology where his computer got cleaned immediately and nothing came of it. But that's a danger to watch out for.
Unfortunately, it's been out there for a long time. It's, you know, not even months or years. It's over a decade where these either fake antivirus scams or I think especially the Microsoft tech support which are kind of fake pop-ups where you see, hey, your device has been infected. Please call our toll-free number to get in touch with a representative to help clean your computer. They do end up making sure that pop-up does go away, but they tend to install other software in the background that you don't want. And so for any of those, I always recommend if you do get a pop-up, know what the pop-ups on your device normally look like. So if you are using an antivirus product bundled with your system, and let's say it's Norton, know what that pop-up is going to look like. So if you do see it in the future, you can help to determine, is this something I should be seeing or is this something I should not be seeing? If you're not using a Microsoft Defender for antivirus, and you get a pop-up from it and it should be turned off, that also should be an indicator. This is a little weird. Maybe I shouldn't really believe this. And another thing I also recommend, you can actually Google a lot of the messages pretty frequently. And so you can get really good examples online in terms of what those pop-up pop-ups look like. And if you do find a report of, this being a fake antivirus pop-up or a tech support scam, at least you have a little bit more information. The phone numbers on the bottom do tend to change, but you can also Google the phone numbers that are given from those remote tech support scams. Usually it happens from clicking on something, usually on a website. It could be something in an email, but often it's going to be something you see, you click on, and it generates this pop-up that, hey, by the way, your computer's locked. Please give us a call. We'll help you out and work you through this. It gets a little bit more dangerous when it's something like ransomware, because it's similar, but your device may be unusable. But those fake tech support scams are so easy. And they, when you do get somebody on the other line, you can be easily tricked to thinking this is a valid, customer service line and they're really helping you out. But in the end, the whole thing was a scam to begin with.
Al in Green Bay called but couldn't stay with us. He has a 2-year-old desktop computer running Windows 10. And lately he's been getting messages about updating to Windows 11. Assuming his computer is capable, is there any reason why he shouldn't be doing that?
Yeah, it's a good question. And usually with any of these upgrades, there's the risk of some software on your device not functioning because the operating system update might be so significant that it's going to cause other software applications to fail. So what I'd always recommend, know what software you're using. See if they are automatically updated. Sometimes you might have to pay for an update. So that's also important to know if you wanted to upgrade and it wasn't available for you automatically. Once you know all those things, I would recommend going ahead and upgrading. It is a little bit different. I went ahead and upgraded my own home computer to Windows 11 when I got prompted. Did not notice a whole lot of issues, at least from the applications that I use. With usually every upgrade, usually something breaks. Some application just doesn't work with the very newest operating system. You need to install an update or something for it to function. Sometimes those updates are immediate. Sometimes those updates are months, and sometimes in the worst case, I've seen years out. But I did not see that experience with, at least for my use of Windows 11. So it seemed to work out pretty well for me. Everyone's experience is going to be different depending on the software that you're using. But since they're already using Windows 10, there's probably a lower chance Windows 11 is going to cause any kind of issue. But just like any big upgrade, make sure you have backups in the event something bad happens, and you can always revert to Windows 10 either through that update process or from your backup.
I had a problem just before the show with Word, Microsoft Word. I was typing something and this is a new computer I haven't used before, and it's a new computer, laptop. And under normal circumstances, if there's something you want to copy and paste to someplace else, you hold down on the computer, and then you can highlight a particular area, and then, you know, hit Command C and Command V, you know, and do that. But in this case, I was not able to highlight. I could highlight fooling around. I could highlight the whole thing once in a while, but I couldn't highlight, you know, the third line and a half of the fourth line and move it somewhere else. Have you ever had a situation like that?
A couple. And usually it can be the formatting of the document where in that particular area, it doesn't like moving between elements. In other cases, I've actually seen where it might be a stuck key or a stuck mouse cursor, because I've had that in the past where I'm trying to highlight something, but if there's like a noted stuck key, maybe it's the control or command key or the shift key, it won't let you highlight because it thinks you're pushing another key anyway. In your case, it sounds like you could highlight some things, just not others. I'm guessing it's something specific about the format of the documents, or maybe even an active window. I've also had instances where just closing and opening the application back up might solve the issue. So it kind of depends on where you're noticing the challenge. But with Word, you also have the web browser-based version. If you have like Office or Microsoft 365, or you might have the desktop fully installed version. And those might also work a little bit differently when doing the copy and paste. So, I mean, the first thing I'd probably do is, you know, save it, close it, open it back up, see if it behaves the same way.
Done that.
It could be something specific about the formatting in that area. And normally a stuck key or a stuck like mouse button could be an issue. And I've actually had that where I've had a stuck button on the mouse and I try to click and it seems like nothing's happening, but that's because the mouse thinks it's actually still clicked down. And honestly, the best way I have to fix that is just to hit it really hard to try to dislodge it so it actually moves. But if you're able to right click and left click normally, I would normally rule that out. If you're able to type text and you don't see any abnormalities where there's a shift here and there shouldn't be, it's probably not a stuck key. Part of me thinks it's probably something specific about the formatting of the document in that one area that it just doesn't like.
Let's see, we've got some emails here. And speaking of problems, we're having our own problems with phone calls right now, but we're working on that. And so I hope people keep trying to call in. Jim from Spring Green wonders, when someone gets a phishing attempt, what is the best way to deal with it? Should the message be deleted, blocked, sent to spam, blocked? What should you do?
Yeah, one thing I always recommend, and this is usually available in most email platforms these days, if you are using a web-based version, you're usually going to have that option. It may not be with every single email client, but if you have a report phishing or report spam button, I highly recommend actually submitting using those buttons. So if you do know this email looks like a scam, I didn't order anything, there's a link in here I'm not going to click on. I'm pretty sure it's a phishing email that wants me to do something. Hit the report phishing button. It might be under either a report button or even like a phishing button, but then it usually goes somewhere where it'll be analyzed either automatically or by an individual or maybe both. And then that can also be used to help protect others. So if you are that first person to say, I saw this email, I think it's phishing, I'm going to report it. It'll be looked at in more detail. And then if it's determined it is phishing, it can be potentially blocked for other users. So that one action can actually help to protect all of the other users using that email system if they've received that same email. So I highly recommend reporting it rather than just deleting it, because it does help others if they receive the same email.
And I think we may have our phone situation taken care of. So there's a lot of open lines right now. And I know there were a lot of people trying to call in. If you were one of them, or even if you weren't, you can call in. Give it a try right now at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. or go ahead and email us to ideas@wpr.org. Ideas@wpr.org. An email from Nancy from Sun Prairie. Since last week, every time she tries to access her app for cribbage, good for her. I like to play cribbage too. So every time she tries to access that app or search for something, she keeps getting messages that the Play Store has stopped. Nancy touches a vacant part of the screen, then tries to get the cribbage game back. And again, she gets that message. And when she goes to the Play Store, it tells her Play Store has stopped.
Yeah, and it sounds like there might be an issue with, and so the Play Store, for anyone who hasn't used an Android, it's, you know, it's the application you have that helps you either purchase or download applications for your phone, similar to the App Store used for an iOS device like an iPhone or an iPad. Usually that stopped message indicates the application had some kind of problem and it had to quit. It could be an issue with the internet connection, maybe not having enough storage or memory space on the device itself. So if a device is out of resources, it may not be able to load everything it needs for that program to function. What I'd probably recommend doing is probably first just restarting the device. Once it loads back up, try to open the Play Store again to see if it loads. If it does load, it sounds like it was likely probably a resource issue. Maybe the cribbage application was using more memory in the background than it should. The device ran out of memory and it caused an issue. If you restart and you still get the same message, I would also recommend changing the internet that you're using. So for most of us using a cellular phone, you might be using cellular or you might be using Wi-Fi or you might be using both. And the phone kind of gets to pick what it wants to do. Turn one of them off, make sure the internet works, try it again, see if you get a change in behavior. So if it can't contact the internet, a lot of the Play Store, it's all internet-based because it's trying to load, you know, frequently used applications, applications that have updates or other recommended applications. So I think doing that would be a recommendation. The other recommendation I'd have, and this is, you know, kind of goes back to the updates. If your device is still supported, check your updates for your phone itself because they might have operating system updates. I would recommend if you do have updates available, get those updates installed and keep on doing that until all of your applications are installed. And then hopefully when you get to the Play Store, it'll also usually have options there to update the applications there. If you don't have automatic updates turned on, I'd recommend doing it. This way you don't hopefully have to worry about it in the future, and it'll at least let you know, hey, I have this big operating system update to perform. I think all of those are going to help out quite a bit, or at least to try to limit what some of the issues might be. Another option you can do is going into your settings on your phone. They do have an application tab, and you can remove any of the storage being used by the Google Play Store. So once you go in, you'll see Google Play Store. You can highlight it. There will be like a storage and cache. Click on that, remove everything, try it again. So in the end, there might be something that it's trying to reference and it's trying to reuse that information. That information might be bad. And so forcing it to download that again will hopefully help the issue. But with all of those steps, I'm hoping one of those are going to help to solve the issue. That storage and cache, I haven't had to do frequently, but every now and again, if you do have a problem, and you know, we see it with web browsers all the time, you have an issue, clear your cache, try it again, and everything might work perfectly. This is a similar use. It's just for the Google Play Store instead of a web browser.
Somebody else wonders about cleaning your technology, and I'm not sure if it's cleaning as in what's a good way to clean the screen off, or is it a question relating to sort of going through your, somehow cleaning out any extraneous materials that may have developed on your, in your computer or on your phone?
Yeah, well, I guess we can cover a little bit of both. So let's say it's physical cleaning and it's a cell phone. Usually, you know, the recommendation is use a slightly damp, lint-free cloth, and it might be a microfiber cloth, which is usually recommended, especially just to make sure you don't scratch anything. For a computer itself, if you have like a desktop computer, those are actually great to blow out with a can of air or a compressor every now and again. They tend to collect a lot of dust.
And
you'll actually be amazed if you've had a computer for a few years and you open that up, it can be kind of scary. But if you do decide to do that and you have a compressor, or if you have some method to blow air to kind of get rid of some of that dust, I do recommend do it outside. Wear a mask because you don't want to breathe any of that stuff in. It's really going to be a collection of anything in your house, which could be, you know, pet hair, dust, a lot of other stuff. And you just do not want to be breathing that in. So I do recommend that. For keyboards, you can do something similar. If you do like eat at your desk, you might find there is food that kind of gets into your keyboard. You can try to do the same thing where you can kind of blow that out. Or you can go to the more extreme version where you have to take off all the keys, and you can find great instructions online of how to do that. Some keyboards are easier for that than others, but you might have limitations there. But otherwise, if it's just the physical cleaning, usually the cell phone is relatively straightforward. You want to use a microfiber cloth, slightly dampened. There are other recommendations actually from the CDC, which came out during COVID. So how to disinfect, which is a kind of a different process of just kind of cleaning it from the day-to-day finger smudges or anything that kind of happens on your device. And so you have a variety of other options there. We could always cover on this, the cleaning, the other things. On
the files.
Device, the digital things.
I got a follow-up to that. What about the files, Len?
Yep. That's a good idea. And so I probably recommend this for both cell phones and desktops or laptops. You know, go through the applications you have on your device. If you don't need it, delete it. Just uninstall it. It'll save space on your device. Might also save you some other resources if it happens to have something running in the background. So try to do that on a regular basis, maybe every 6 months. You can do it more or less frequently, depending on the time you have available. But if you don't need it, get rid of it. Same kind of goes for files. So if you do have files on your device, it's kind of like anything you might have in your apartment or in your home. You look at that thing. I never really used that. I've had it for about 2 years. Do I really need to keep that? Do the same thing with those files. So if you see a folder with some content in it, maybe you really determine you don't need it, and you can remove it from your device, or maybe you just want to back it up, put it on the shelf, and if you ever need it, you can get to it, but remove it from your primary device. The nice thing about doing that too, let's say you do have a device you either really don't need regularly, and so you put it on a flash drive or an external hard drive, you put it on a shelf, and you remove it from your computer. Well, if you are using your computer, you click on a bad attachment, it does something to your computer. One, you know, they can't destroy that data because you have another copy of it. But they also can't take the data and do something else with it. So that also lessens the risk if somebody were to get access to your device and actually access that content. So those are some things I'd recommend, but definitely on the cell phones too. It's so easy to install a ton of apps. You know, go through, make a day of it, uninstall all the apps you don't think you need. You can do the same thing for files too, because it's very easy to download a file and just not think about it. And, you know, your downloads folder has, you know, thousands of files you just never look at, but it's taking up all this room that you could be using for other stuff. So I do recommend doing that frequently, especially if you do run into resource issues where programs don't load, you don't have space. That can be a really good time to do that. Windows and other operating systems will actually prompt you. You're kind of out of space. We'd like to help you clean up some stuff. And so they might recommend files to remove based upon age and making sure you can use your device too. So some of that's going to be automated, but if you can make a regular practice of it, that can be great too.
Charles in Lone Rock wonders, how can he turn off auto prompts when typing an email to Yahoo?
Oh, that's a good question.
An email in Yahoo, not to Yahoo, but in Yahoo.
Yeah, most of the, and I actually haven't had a Yahoo account for a while, but most of the applications will have a settings option, and they'll have an autocorrect or spelling or grammar option that you can actually turn on or off. So my first guess in which to look is going to be under the settings for your account. Usually it's going to be probably under your avatar or under your name, and they'll have a settings option. Go there and look for grammar or spelling. It might also be autocorrect. The terminology can be different depending on what application you're using.
Yeah.
And it might have just an on or off option. You can just turn it off and you'll never have to worry about it again. Others might actually give you the option. Once it gives you a recommendation, they might give you a nice quick option where it just turn this off in the future. But that does depend on, you know, the email service that you're using. So go to the settings. I would honestly be surprised if it's not there, but it's a possibility. It's always there. That used to feel like a premium service a long, long time ago, where you got to correct your spelling, and now it's just kind of a normal thing, even when you're just using a web browser.
Doug emailed us. He has Windows 10 and uses Outlook from Office to download emails, personal email on earthlink.net, business emails on Pear Networks. And last week, Outlook lost the ability to download from Earthlink. He can access webmail online, and he can send from Outlook on Earthlink. And he can also download from Pear Networks. So he wonders, what the heck's going on? He's lost the ability to download from Earthlink.
Yeah, that's a good question. There could be a variety of things that did happen, including Earthlink may have changed how people can download email. There are actually several ways you can download email from a mail server, depending on the service that you're using. They may have one actually changed the backend mail storage that they're using, which could be a completely different mail service now. Or they could have turned off older features that are less secure. So what I'd recommend doing is probably calling Earthlink or even checking their website to see if they did have any recent email updates that would have caused the issue, because they can at least walk you through the existing settings you have in Outlook and then confirm, yes, these are correct, or no, these are not, and then kind of troubleshoot from there. My guess is maybe something on the back end of their system changed and you need to update your email settings accordingly. It could be a password issue, but since you're able to access it online, it seems like it's probably okay. Although, if I stated that and then you just thought, oh, I changed my password last week, your password might be saved in Outlook. And so, you know, go in into your settings for the account and update your password if that's the case. They do have the check email button or check connectivity button just to make sure your email does function. So you could go through your email account in the Outlook settings just to do that manually to see if you get any other options. But my best recommendation would actually be to just call Earthlink or look on online to see if they did change any of their email settings, and then kind of do the walkthrough with their Outlook recommendations and then really compare what do you have and what do they recommend.
Rosemary emailed us, and we'll get to that email. But first, let me remind you that we're taking a look at tech issues today. Still having some problems with our phones, but our email is working just fine. I'll give the number. You can give it another shot at 1-800-642-1234. But otherwise, email us. The email address, ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Jesse LeGru, our guest today, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group, and I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at technology on the program today with Jesse LeGrew from Madison College's Technology Services Group, where he serves as an information security architect. It's great to have him with us. Shoot us an email with a question at ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. So Rosemary emailed us. She had Windows installed on her HP laptop, which she purchased in 2018, and she had printer and scanner issues when it was first installed about a year ago. But they were resolved. But now she wonders about an update. Do you think it's safe to install Windows 11 version 22H2 is what she's wondering. She's probably worried about, all right, now I'm going to have a whole bunch of problems again.
Yeah, that's it's kind of a challenging situation to be in. So you don't necessarily need to upgrade at the moment to, you know, maintain the support of Windows 10. So Windows 10 will be supported until near the end of 2025.
She's in Windows 11. She is in the first in the first version, but now they're at, yeah, but she had trouble at first when it got installed. With her printer and so forth. And now they're saying, here's an update, you know, this new version. should I take a chance on the new version, the update?
I think it's probably okay to do the update. I would, if you do have the printer, if the printer and scanner are one device, which they might be or they might be separate, they might have recommendations on the vendor's website in terms of whether you should actually update to that version of Windows 11 or not. Because they might also say, you know, this is supported for Windows 11, but if you are at this latest version, it may not be supported until we release updated software, which could, you know, potentially create a different issue. I would think that's going to be a lower risk. It's not going to be, it's still, you know, a larger update, but I think the printer and scanner should be okay. But looking at the vendor website is really going to give you a better recommendation, because they've usually tested it or received reports from other users as to what, you know, the behavior was once that upgrade did finish. Also, if you do have backups and are using some of the system restore features, you might be able to, you know, capture, you know, things that are working today, perform the upgrade. If the upgrade doesn't work, revert back. And that way, at least, you can kind of test how it would look if you did upgrade. Sometimes, you know, going forwards and backwards can also be a challenge, but that's another option if you don't see that there are any risks when looking at the vendor website in terms of, is this supported by this latest version of Windows that you might upgrade to?
Claire says there's a new TV show out called The Last of Us. Follows the story of a video game. Are you familiar with the series, with the TV?
Yes.
And I guess, what do you think of it?
Well, and the game was, well, fun to play. So they have two games, and this is kind of an interesting mix between, like, technology and popular media. There have always been challenges with moving from video games to on-screen, you know, formats, whether it's TV or whether it's movies. We'll have new Mario coming out, so there's another one there. But sometimes that can be kind of a challenging transition. So far, you know, the latest series has actually been enjoyable to watch, and actually in many cases very, very close to the game, which is interesting, because looking at other media too, let's say it's what's a big popular one, Game of Thrones, where there's a series of books. You know, it kind of moved between the books from the TV series, Sometimes there are deviations and they go completely against the, not against the material, but it just deviates, either because of the timeline when the material is actually available to build the story for on screen. And it can be quite different. So far, this has actually been a really truthful adaptation to the materials from a video game, which, I mean, most people would probably state that taking a video game and making a series out of it is probably not a great idea because it's a video game, right? Could there really be a great story? But in this case, they've actually done, I think, a terrific job. And have actually, in many cases, I think, even improved on the storytelling and told a different story
Yeah.
that was potentially even more impactful. So it's actually been a great series to compare and see how that material does differ from what was before it.
Veronica wondered why, when she is listening to WPR streaming app and goes to Facebook, the audio on the app stops. Is there something she needs to do in Facebook?
It actually might be the browser. I think I actually noticed this before with a different browser a few days ago. Previous behavior with at least web browsers I've used in the past, let's say you have two or three tabs open. One of those tabs you might notice there's like an audio symbol on top, noting that this tab is playing audio. If you move to a different tab, previous behavior that I've noticed is that it would continue playing, but now it's actually doing switching where it's actually going from one tab to another, and you actually need to be at that active tab. I haven't actually looked into this on the browsers that I'm currently using. It's very likely there's probably a browser setting that allows you to not follow audio from tab to tab. Because I think I did notice that on a browser. I think in the past where that behavior changed, I would look in your browser settings just to see if you can turn that on or off. You might be able to do it from the context menu, which is kind of the right click option menu when browsing on a tab. So it might give you an option there of, keep this audio running. But I'd recommend taking a look there and the browser settings to see if you can kind of change that. But unfortunately, I haven't looked into that solution myself.
Emmanuel in Strawberry Point, Iowa, emailed, and he wonders, is there a program that line by line will make note of everything sending him data? He wonders that in order to see just where intrusion attempts are coming from, as well as what his computer is sending out. He's curious about this because so often when he's not trying to send or receive anything, he nonetheless sees lights on the DSL modem flashing.
Yes, that's a good question. There are a few different ways to do it. Sometimes the router or access points that you might purchase actually have those capabilities built in, where they can give you a very user-friendly interface to take a look at the information, especially in a more aggregated form. So you get pie charts, generally what websites are being accessed, whether they are, on a potentially on a bad list, a list that you don't want people accessing, where you can actually have some more controls also to block it. If you actually really wanted to get into the raw data itself, that's going to be not necessarily more challenging, but it might be more challenging to interpret. And there are a variety of tools out there that you can use to do what they call packet captures, which will actually give you the raw data that you can take a look at. Granted, if you're browsing a website and the data is encrypted, you may not be able to read that data, but you will be able to get some statistics from it. There are great options out there. Some open source options for routers might be pfSense, and you can find different varying levels of hardware and software to do that, to actually get those packet captures and do a lot of other things with it and analyze it with other tools. So if you really want to go the high tech in the weeds route, packet captures are probably going to be what you're going to want to do. And you could probably search for days on great ways to do that at home. But you can also utilize some of the other tools that make it a little bit more user friendly. But if you do want to get into the details, look for your options for packet captures. and one product that I do like to help give you a little bit more data without needing to look into the weeds is a product open source called Zeek, which will also
Zeek?
Give you some
like
Zeek.
Z-E-E-K?
That is correct.
And what is it?
And that can, it'll help you look at really the communications that are happening from device to device, at least depending on where you're kind of placing that sensor to collect some of that data. But it saves you some space and it gives you something to look at. If you've never dove into this world, it will no doubt give you days, weeks, months, and maybe even years of things to do.
Jesse LeGrew, our guest today, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. A sure way to get through to us today is to shoot us an email. Go to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org, and explain what your issue is, and Jesse will take a look at it. We are going to take a quick look at the news now, and we'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Jesse. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at technology today with our guest, Jesse LeGrew, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. You can email him at ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And an email from Ann in Madison. She has an old a first-generation smartphone. I don't even know this one. Is it Moto or Motox or Moto X? Anyway, all of her text messages disappeared this morning. They just were gone. She wants to get them back. Text messages are difficult to get back, aren't they?
Yeah, and it does depend on how and where the text messages are stored. So a variety of like how basically any mobile device or computer does work. If you have data stored on it and let's say it's deleted, the data is actually not removed unless you delete it in a very special way. So the data still exists. What you're really telling the computer is, hey, by the way, where I'm storing this data, it's okay to be written to. So treat it like it's free space. But until something actually writes data to those locations, the data is still there. So if it's possible that those areas of the phone have not been overwritten with other data, there could be a possibility someone could try to retrieve the data. Unfortunately, I don't know how, you know, for example, platforms might store that data in a variety of different formats. Even if you saw it on the device, I don't know how easy it would be to simply read. I'd probably recommend, if you can't see it on the device, I'd probably recommend reaching out to a couple different computer areas that might do data recovery or data restoration for devices so they can see, look into the options. Because if that data has just been, let's say it's been allocated or stated to the device, hey, this is free space, that data could still be there, assuming that nothing else has failed or everything else is okay. And if somebody's able to get that data back, they might be able to get it back so you can read it. Whether they're going to be able to get it back so you can actually see it in the cell phone like you did before may or may not be the case. So they might be able to get you the data, but they may not be able to get it into a format where you can actually see it the way you did before. You're going to be basically starting from scratch, but at least you'll have it to reference.
Yeah. I know somebody who lost a good friend and had a whole series of messages back and forth and hasn't lost it yet, or at least hasn't said anything about it, but it'd be one of those things that they would definitely not want to lose. I know that for sure, because it was a nice thing. Terry from Amherst emailed us. They have a new 6-month-old 2TB computer. And when in Excel, they've observed a large gray colored square. It's about 5 to 10 rows by 5 to 10 rows covering the text. So it's something blocking the text. Happens at least one time a session of going on their computer. Terry can't seem to get rid of it unless they log out of the document, then go back into it. Needless to say, they save often because of this. Any ideas?
My initial idea is sometimes the display can be distorted by video drivers. So in the end, you know, you have a video card, something that's responsible for translating what should be, you know, coming from the device onto a physical screen. So it could be a TV, it could be a LCD monitor, could be a couple monitors, but it helps to generate that picture. If there's any time you see unusual artifacts, you know, maybe a pixelated display or just something that shouldn't be there, the first thing I always recommend is look for updated video drivers. And in many cases, you can get them directly. You'll get them through Windows updates. Sometimes you have to turn that additional feature on. Otherwise, if you do have a video card that is by a well-known video card manufacturer, I'd probably recommend getting it directly from their website. They'll usually have more fully featured software and drivers that will help with that. So that would be my first recommendation, is just to try that out and see if you get a difference in behavior. Another option I would have is also update Office. Just make sure everything is up to date, because usually that's the first thing if you continue to have issues. Beyond that, if you, let's say your video drives are up to date, Office is up to date, Windows is up to date, everything looks fine, you could try that document on a different computer to see if you get a different behavior. If you get the same behavior, it might actually be the file. It may be something in the file. And if you do have just like plain text data with no formatting, you can do kind of a copy and paste, but do like a paste of values only, which should take away all formatting or anything else. You kind of start from scratch, but you have all your data. And then you can kind of go from there and maybe change some of the other options. But if it is something on your device that's causing an issue, you know, video is usually the first place I'm going to go, because this is something you're seeing. Whether it should be there or not is a big question. But if the updates don't help, it's likely there might actually just be something in terms of how the file itself has that text formatted that's causing that artifact. And then hopefully just, you know, either doing a select all, remove formatting, or pasting it into a brand new Excel document without formatting will hopefully help the issue too.
Terry was also wondering if you had a suggestion of easy to use external storage, size and brand.
I'd say for external storage, what I'd always recommend is, one, it depends on how much space you need. So if you don't need a lot of space, and by a lot, I mean over a terabyte, you can probably get a flash drive. So, you know, a small flash drive that's going to work well for your needs. When it's small, you can put it into a pocket. You don't have to worry about a whole lot of space. And it's you're really going to work from device to device. So it's going to be very easy and mobile. In terms of, you know, different vendors, they're all over the place. Kensington, Samsung, you'll see a lot of the main brands. If you go walk into any store that's selling computer components, you're going to see a variety of different manufacturers out there. Usually for a lot of the flash drives, you know, Samsung is going to be pretty common. Kensington is going to be pretty common. But you'll see others out there. If you want more space, external hard drives, which are going to be more spacious, they may require external power. Those are going to help you with having more storage. And it's also going to take up a little bit more room, but you know, they'll work really well. Companies out there, Seagate, Western Digital, there are others. But those are, you know, two very common brands you're going to see out there. But both of those options, they're really easy to use. You plug it in, it shows up either on your desktop as an alias maybe it shows up on Windows Explorer if you have a PC, and it shows up as a different drive letter, and you just copy and paste data to it. So it's very, very straightforward. The other options might be like network attached storage. That requires additional work. Definitely a good option, especially if you want to share with multiple computers, but it's not as straightforward. There's a little bit more work to it to connect and get it configured.
Yeah.
But if you just want to plug it in and go, flash drives are the easiest one. You can get a lot of space
Yeah.
for a really small package, and it could serve everything you need. But if you really want a lot more space, an external hard drive, that is what they call a DAS or direct attached storage, meaning you're just plugging it directly into your computer. That's just a very easy way to go.
Kevin says when he goes to send an email on his iPad, he types in a letter and all addresses with that letter in it appear. And how can he remove all those choices out of the email without deleting the contacts? He wants to clean up his choices, and the iPad is also linked to an iPhone.
My guess, and this I haven't tried it with, if you have iCloud syncing on where you're syncing settings and data and everything else, I don't know how that would work on there. Usually for a lot of the automatically populated addresses, most programs have two ways of doing it. One is it'll populate based on names you've used frequently in the past, so kind of a frequently used contacts. The other option is it will just list everyone if it matches that first letter. And that's just what it's going to do. You may not have any great way of modifying it. For an iOS device, so iPad, iPhone, I would recommend going into settings and messaging, because you might have an option if you are using the built-in mail app for the iPad of changing how the address lookup functions. It may not have that setting, but that is exactly where I'd go. If you're using another app, let's say you're using Outlook, you might have to look in the Outlook specific applications, or even in the contacts option within preferences. One thing I have noticed with previous versions of Outlook, when you type in a name, it will populate a smaller list. But if you want to get rid of those lists because they're inaccurate, they usually have an X on the right-hand side. You click on the X, it kind of removes it from that frequently used contacts. Once again, we're talking about an iPhone or an iPad. That may not work. So you might have limited options there, or it might just work differently. But I would recommend taking a look at your contacts. Usually that's where it's going to be drawing all that information from. And then go to your preferences and settings to see if you can tweak the behavior of the mail app, for how it decides to view any of those pre-populated lists.
Speaking of all the problems we've been talking about, we've been having our own with phones, and I think our IT people have figured it out. So if you want to give us a call, you can at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Fortunately, people have been emailing right and left too, so we've got plenty of those. Jim and Spooner wonders why he can't get a printer that doesn't have a Bluetooth option. He's annoyed when his other electronics try to link with his Bluetooth printer.
Yeah, and there are printers with Bluetooth available. So it depends on the device that you get. One of the downsides of Bluetooth is it is usually limited range. So you might have a few meters, you might have tens of meters, depending on the version of Bluetooth and the capabilities. But you can get a Bluetooth printer. Usually you're going to need to be relatively close to the printer itself. But they are available. So if you are interested in using Bluetooth,
But if
you
you're
could
not,
do.
what about if you're not?
If you don't want to use Bluetooth, usually for printers, they will have an option to turn it off. So just like there are usually other options in a printer you can use, let's say wireless in addition to Bluetooth. So those are two different wireless options you can use to connect to a printer. You can turn one or both of those options off. Usually, you can go to the settings, either on the panel of the printer itself, or most printers, especially if it's network capable, you can actually pull up a website for your printer and actually turn on or off those features. So if you do want to turn Bluetooth off because it does have it turned on and you really don't want to use it, just go into your printer settings. I would be surprised if it had that option that you couldn't turn it off, but usually you're just going to have an on-off button.
Yeah.
Turn it off and you should be set.
Well, here's a call. Susie in Scandinavia. Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I caught the first question about text messages, and I've had that sinking feeling about losing text messages, especially when I have to change phones. So I have discovered there are apps out there for saving your text messages. You can save it to your cloud storage. I'm sure there are other options, but I do sleep better at night because I know I can do that. And you can set up the backup for whenever you want it to happen, or you can back up certain text message threads. I do have a security concern about them, and I'd like to hear what your guest has to say about that type of app.
Yeah.
Well, and I'll put my answer off the air.
Thank you, Susie. Thank you very much for calling.
Yeah, and that's, there are a lot of great resources out there, so you can back up not just text messages, but contacts, any other data on your phone, which can make it restoring it to a different device a lot easier. And in fact, a lot of Android phones have that built in with Google services, so they might be able to store that data. So if you get a new phone, you can easily just synchronize it and get all your stuff back, or use multiple devices with all the same settings. And I think, as noted, there are potential concerns with some of that. So that means they might have access to sensitive data on your device. You may have text messages that have sensitive information, and you are potentially sharing that with a third party that has the potential to be breached. So, you know, somebody could compromise their systems and get access to your text messages. Or worst case, they might use your text messages for things that you really don't want them to. Yeah. And it could be one of those risks we see with a lot of software where unless you read the fine print, you may not know what's happening with it. And then that comes down to the terms of service or the end user license agreements that kind of come with these software packages. And so if anyone ever does really have a concern about, I don't know if I should be sharing this data with this third party, I don't know what they're doing with it, that's the first place I go. Because usually they need to list that out. And just reading that, you know, I've read a lot of them where I found, oh, you're doing that with my data. Okay, that's interesting. I'm not sure if I like that. And it at least gives you more information to make a decision in terms of whether you do want to use that service or not. A lot of devices, there are also other local ways to back up that data. So you can back it up to, let's say, an external drive, maybe a different service that you're using to store other data. You know, it could be a cloud service, maybe it's iCloud, you know, for example, with a lot of the built-in synchronization there with messages. It could be Google, it could be Dropbox, it could be many of these other storage options where maybe you know they already have certain data you're worried about, but at least it's all in the same bucket, which you basically have a different level of trust with that organization. So there's only so much you can do. Or you can be extremely paranoid, back everything up only to micro SD cards, which are locally available to be plugged into your cell phone, and then store that away. So just like you can back up your computer to a cloud resource, you can back up your computer to an external hard drive that the only way they can get into it is if they get into where you're living and physically steal it. And you can do the same thing with a cell phone. You can back up all your stuff locally and store it off somewhere else. But it is a concern. I always recommend researching a little bit about the organization that is helping to perform those services. It's likely they're storing that data for you, reading the end user license agreement, terms of service, or just other people's reviews can be interesting. Reviews are also one of those things where don't just read a couple, read the good and the bad. Sometimes more of those statements will have different weights because the perspective they have, or maybe the knowledge and skill set they have about the tool or the company. Unfortunately, just there's a little bit of research to be done.
Yeah.
But you have other options. So if you were really concerned, there are other local options where you can back up just to your device. And check your device settings because it'll also say what those apps can do with your data or what you're sharing with that application. So maybe they can only access data locally but can't access the internet, which helps you limit where they can actually move that data around. So your application permissions as you're installing them are also really important to keep track of.
Warren emailed us. He has a Dell laptop. It works well for the most part. When he doesn't touch the keyboard for a while, it goes to sleep. When he wants to wake it up, he can't just touch the mouse or hit a key on the keyboard in order to wake it up. Instead, he's obliged to hit the power button on the laptop, and eventually he is required to re-enter his device PIN. Anything he can do to change that?
Yeah, it sounds like the device may be on a hibernate setting instead of like a screen deactivation setting. If it's Windows, usually you'll have the option between like hibernate or standby, or maybe just deactivating the screen. I would take a look at those settings. My guess is you're on hibernate. You probably want just about anything else except for hibernate. So that'll keep the device running, and you just need to hit, spacebar or maybe the mouse to make the screen become active. But you might also see there are options to, you know, do you require me to hit the power button? Do you require me to hit a key? Do you require a password when it opens the next time? And a lot of those settings are actually built in there. And so you can tweak it quite a bit to what you're looking for. But I'm guessing it's on hibernate. Put it on something else outside of hibernate and likely you won't need to hit the power button. It does mean it might be using more power while it's running, but you will get the experience that you're looking for.
Krista emailed us. She's got a 5-year-old Acer computer, but interested perhaps in a new one. Basically uses it for the current one for Gmail, Google Docs, and bill paying. Any recommendations for a budget-wise computer?
Yeah, it's a good question. And since the services listed off were a lot of Google services, one of the things I'd always recommend for people to look into, look for a Chromebook. You might be able to actually get pretty much everything you need for, relatively inexpensive, maybe a couple hundred dollars with the basics for being able to do word processing, potentially bills, internet, websites, that kind of thing. If you don't need to install a lot of applications that might be dependent on having Windows or dependent on having Mac OS, a Chromebook can be a really great option. And it can also be far less expensive than a lot of the counterparts. Granted, you're paying for more capabilities, but maybe you don't need them.
Maybe you don't need them. Well, Jesse, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it, and we'll look forward to your next visit. Thank you.
Looking forward to it. Thank you.
Jesse LeGru, our guest, information security architect. He works out of Madison College, out of their technology services group, and helps with designing and developing and implementing security standards and protocols. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about how to keep your heart healthy on that Valentine's Day, just in time for it. Cardiologist talks about heart treatments and options you have before surgery. That's tomorrow at 11. In the meantime, hey, stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.